Want to begin as we have begun every day so far and to look at the first thesis statement that's made in the book. It kind of helps us stay on track for what we're looking at as we look through Ecclesiastes. And as we note here again in verses 2 and 3, the writer says, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" All right, hopefully by this point, if you've been able to be with us each day, we're kind of hitting a rhythm for the book. The writer is saying to us, there are lots of things that just don't look right under the sun. There are a lot of folks who look like they're getting away with stuff, and there's a lot of good folks who look like they're suffering, and people are dying just like the animals die, and it just doesn't really look like anybody or anything's in control here. But the writer has constantly said, don't fall prey to that. What things may look like on the surface, when you see the big picture, you realize that everything is under someone's control, that the Lord has everything taken care of. We may not understand it in this life. We may not ever figure it out while we're here, but his constant theme has been trust God. In fact, as we've looked at these first two of the foundational views of life, he's concluded them the same way. He says, what I figured out is be content with what you have, be happy with what you've got, realize that God has given it to you, and don't worry about all this other stuff. Let God take care of it. And today, as we begin this third cycle through, as we look at this third view of life, we're going to see very similar things to what we've seen previously. I do think that as we get to this part of the book, the writer is telling us a little bit more about God, though. That first cycle that we went through, that first observation of life, God is almost completely left out of it. Yesterday, as we looked at that second view, we see God coming into it just a little bit more, and today I think we still see even yet more of God being discussed. But even with that, let's not lose our theme. The theme is life under the sun. What happens when you leave God out of the equation? The writer's still going to be dealing with that and telling us how to deal in living with a world like that. So with that being said, let's go ahead on over to chapter 6. Hey, to chapter 6. And this third observation of life now commences. Very much like what we've seen before, it begins where he left off with the previous. What we saw yesterday as we left off is the writer was telling us about the dangers of replacing God with wealth. And he's going to say, wealth just makes you want more. It makes you sit up not worrying about it. It makes you discontent with what you have if you're not careful. So he said, don't trade God in for wealth. Be happy with what he's given to you. Be joyful with that. And so today we're going to pick up, we're going to see that third observation is going to deal with some similar things. And in this first section that we're going to look at today, we might just sum it up with these three words. He's going to do some supposition. He's going to show us how we find satisfaction. And he's going to tell us about the sovereignty of God. Okay, so these three ideas we find coming out very clearly, first of all. So let's talk first of all about this idea of supposition. And we go to chapter 6. And we might note verses 1 and 2 as he kind of sets up this theme. He says, there is an evil I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he has, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. All right, so we're under the sun. Once again, we're back to this man who has worked hard all of his life, and when he dies, what happens to everything that's been that he's been working for all of these years? All right, now let's jump on into verses 3 through 6 and see how he builds on this idea. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For if he comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered, moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place. Now, as we think about this supposition that he makes, three times within this section, the writer is going to tell us that here is a man who is not enjoying what he's got. In fact, what we see is not only that, the writer tells us he is unable to enjoy what's been given to him. The writer puts this in terms that might not have the same kind of appeal to us as it would the people who heard in the days of its writing. But I want you to look at the description that the man has. Now, one thing that does stand out that I think transcends the generations. He says, here is a man who is given a very long life. In fact, he says, here is a man who lives 2,000 years, 1,000 years twice over. And what might not have the same appeal to us says this man has 100 sons. We think about that. We think about how tiring that might be. But you think about here in this day, that was a sign of wealth, of prosperity. You had a very large family. And so he exaggerates it. He says, here is a man, and he lives long on the earth. And in the terms of mankind, under the sun kind of thinking, here is a man who has great prestige in the fact that his name is going to be carried on, 100 sons who are going to carry that on. And as he draws this picture, he says, this is a man because God has not given him the ability to enjoy his wealth, is going to die a miserable man. Now, can you imagine that? It's kind of like what we talked about earlier. We take that in that first cycle where the writer says, I had wealth and I had family and I had prosperity and I had slaves taking care of everything. And we said, okay, who would not enjoy that now? Very few would raise their hands. Well, in the day of this writing, if you said you can live 2,000 years, you can have 100 sons, the people of that era would have said, yes, it's exactly what I want. And the writer says, no, you don't. If you've not got God in the picture. If this is all under the sun kind of thinking, this is not what you desire. And so he draws then a very interesting picture. He says, if you do not have God in your life, wealth can bring no satisfaction. Now, have you noticed that theme coming up constantly so far through the book? Almost from the very beginning, we've seen where the writer is saying, you may think this is going to satisfy you. You may think that the things of earth are going to take care of you, but you're not going to be happy. You're not going to have satisfaction with that if God is left out. Remember yesterday, that eternity in our hearts. It can't be filled with gold. Can't be filled with wealth. And that's what the writer is trying to bring out to us. And so he actually puts this in a very sad picture. Some similar passages that you might think about, the book of Job, chapter 3 and verse 16, Job is going to use this same kind of idea. The psalmist in 58:8 is going to use this. I've tried to be really constant in just not leaving the book of Ecclesiastes this week. But I think it's important for us to consider these passages because they're very much alike. The writer says, here is a man who has everything, at least in the eyes of the world, but he has no satisfaction because he does not have God. The writer says, it would be better if he had never lived. And in fact, the picture that he draws out here is he says, a stillborn child has more advantage than this man does. A stillborn child is better off than this man. And that's pretty much what Job says. You know, Job was not a godless man by any means, But everything was taken from him. He just had his relationship with God was all that was left. And as Job is kind of bemoaning that situation, he says, "Cursed be the day that it was announced that a son had been born." Writer of Psalms 58 is going to make the same kind of conclusion. And so the writer here is saying, you just got to realize what I've been telling you all along is the case. Wealth is not going to satisfy. Okay, now with that kind of foundational stone being laid there, he then moves on. And he's going to tell us about satisfaction, but now that term's a little bit deceiving. Because what we want to see first of all is kind of the link with what we just talked about with wealth. The writer's about to tell us something under the sun that's going to happen. So let's go ahead on down to verse 7. And he says here, again, not really breaking the thought at all. He says, "All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied." Now pay particular attention to verse 8. He says, "For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living?" What's the idea here? There's differing opinions. But I think what the writer is telling us is the wise man and the fool, just like in death, share the same experience when they come up against the unsatisfied wealthy man. The man who has a lot of wealth is going to, in a sense, come down on those who are underneath him. They're going to be oppressed and subject to the appetite of the wealthy, whether wise or fool. Okay. So here's another one of those ideas where we're talking about here is this very wise man, and one of the things we may not understand really well under the sun is he is suffering just like the fool is. Here is this man who's been put in a position of power. He has great wealth. He has an appetite for wealth. And he's taking advantage of the wise just like he's taking advantage of the fool. Where's the fairness in that? And the answer to that is, under the sun, there is no fairness. Under the sun, you're not going to find that making a lick of sense. But that's not where the writer stops. He's going to continue with this idea, and he's going to say, if you want to be wise in the above the sun sense, just be satisfied with what you've got. Don't become that man who is oppressing everybody else. Don't become that guy who's coming down bitterly on everyone. In fact, go ahead on down as we look at this, down to verse 9. He says, "Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind." So in this satisfaction, he says, just be content with what you have. And so what we find is that this idea is fitting right in with the same conclusions that we've been seeing all along. Don't thirst for wealth. You're not going to be satisfied by it. Don't become someone who has left God out, and so he's picking on everybody else. He's just simply living a godless life, and he's taking advantage of everyone. The writer says, if you've got real wisdom, if you've got wisdom that transcends the sun, just be content. Don't crave what you don't need. And he allows that then to move us into this third point of the idea of the sovereignty of God. This is another constant within the book. And I want us to pick up on this. The writer is telling us if we're going to be content and happy, we've got to appreciate that God is God and we are not. That's how we find happiness. Under the sun, people can't figure that out. They can't come to terms with that. But the writer here is saying to us, be satisfied, but also realize that there's a big difference between you and God. And his point primarily, at least in the first part of this, is don't try to argue with him. You're going to lose that argument. If you try to fight against God, you are in a fight you cannot win. And so let's look at what he has to say here. Pick up with me in verse 10. He says, whatever has come to be has already been named, and is known. It is known what man is, and what he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for a man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? So the writer first of all says to us, don't argue with God. He's done several things here, and the writer brings this out. The first thing he says is, God has named you. Now that's important, especially as we consider the culture that this was in. When you had the ability to name someone, that was viewed as your power over that person. We even think about this today. You know, when you have a child and you're coming up with a name for that child, and you start thinking, whoa, for the next 75, 80, 90 years, this child is going to have to go by that moniker, the one that I put on. That kind of makes you realize you're in a position of power. Well, the writer takes this a step further, and he says, God is the one who has named you. God is the one who is in control. And he says, God is stronger than you are as well. And so his point is, why are you even thinking about arguing with him? Why are you even thinking about taking on God? But yet, how many people do that very thing? People who are living under the sun try to treat Jehovah as though he is just, well, two ways. Sometimes a buddy, you know, this guy that you'd go out and play golf with. Or else they treat him as someone who's even less worthy than that. And the writer is saying, okay, what are you missing here? What are you not seeing about God? He controls you. He's named you. He's stronger than you are. And he goes on to say, he can see what you cannot. You can't see 1 second in front of you. God knows the whole thing. God's got it under control. He knows what's going to happen. And so the writer then leaves us with what we might call rhetorical questions, although I think he's going to answer them anyway. Verse 12, as he comes to his point here, he says, for who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which passes like a shadow? The answer to that's God. And secondly, he says, for who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? That would be God also. Neither of those answers can come to any kind of human response. We can't do it. We don't know what's going to happen, but God does. And so let's look at this together now. Why do you want to be wealthy? Why do you want wealth to replace God? You don't. Why is it that you can find satisfaction? It's not in that idea of amassing things under the sun. It's the idea of coming to terms with appreciating what God has given you, using it for his purposes. And thirdly, how can you know who God is? Recognize his sovereignty. Don't crowd him. Don't try to take his place. Don't try to tell him what to do. He knows it all, and you don't. Now, is the writer speaking sense to us? Is he putting it in very plain terms? If you're under the sun, he's saying, you don't get it. You don't understand any of this. But if you're living above the sun, if you're transcending, you understand fully what's being talked about here. Now, it's kind of interesting at this point. He makes somewhat of a break, although I don't think it's a very big one, because the next section he's going to say, I think pretty much is, don't let this get you down. As you're looking at all of these things, you may have a tendency to be a little depressed. You may have a tendency to let it get to you. And I think what the writer is saying is things really may not be as bad as you think they are. And I think what's going on is those questions that were asked in verse 12, he's kind of responding. He's kind of taking that a step further and telling us a little bit about God. Now, a couple of these are going to sound familiar. He's dealt with them before. But as he talks about this, he says, first of all, let me talk a little bit about death. We've talked a lot about that, the writer says. But I want to tell it to you from a different angle now. Thus far in our study, what have we seen him saying about death? He's saying that under the sun, we're just like the animals. The dog dies, we die. The cat dies, we die. Nobody can tell any difference between that. And you're forgotten. You know, he's given us a very depressing picture of that. Here, he's going to change perspectives a bit. And he's going to say, now while under the sun, they can't understand a lot about that. Let me tell you some things that may make death sound not quite as bad as what we've talked about prior to this. Let's look at these first four verses. He says in verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go into the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. How many times have you heard that read at a funeral? That is a standard passage that we come to. Because I think we understand at that point a little bit of what the writer is talking about. But yet you look at this and really, we may grapple with making sense out of it. Notice again what he says there, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Would we think about it that way? You know, we think about a child coming into the world and how blessed and how happy that is. And we think about a funeral, how sad that is. And we say, I just don't know what the writer's talking about. Well, we have to put it in context. The writer is not telling us to walk around miserable, sad all the time, looking for a funeral to attend. That is not his point. The writer is saying to us, I want you to take a little bit different look at death. We've looked at it under the sun. We've talked about it under the sun. But let's make a point or two about it here. I think what he's saying is when we are confronted with death, it forces us to examine our mortality. That's one of the blessings of death. When someone dies, when we go into that house of mourning, it is forcing us to say, this is going to happen to me. This is going to occur in my life. And it takes us a while to come to terms with that. You know, I work around teenagers about 9 months out of the year. And with teenagers, it's not when I die, it's if I die. It's almost looked at as, this is not going to happen to me. And I don't know when exactly we make the transition from that idea. It's certainly past our teenage years. We have an intellectual view of death. In our minds, we understand it happens, but in our hearts, we don't think it's going to happen to us. It's going to happen to everybody else. It's somehow going to leave us alone. But then at some point, we hit the maturity of saying, it's coming. It's going to happen to me. And I think that's perhaps a signal of when our perspective changes from below the sun to above the sun. This is something that's going to occur in my life. Now, why do I need to concentrate on that? Well, when the writer makes his conclusion at the end of the book, he's going to say, you want your spirit to go to God. You want to return to Him. Therefore, you've got to be prepared for that day. So he says to us, and I've mentioned this before, but I just think it illustrates, it's as though he is taking our heads that's trying to turn in every direction away from this subject and saying, look at it. Understand this is going to happen to you. And he makes a very interesting point that I think fits our day quite well. He says, don't try to replace this topic with frivolity. Don't try to laugh it off. I think that's a point that he makes here as we look down to verse 4 when he says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. We try to laugh it off. We try to say, this isn't going to happen to me. We try to make a big joke out of death. Why? Because we don't want to deal with it. Our society fights aging more than any society ever has. You think about all of the things that we have to keep us looking young, making us feel young, we dress young. Some people think that that's just because we're vain. I think it's because we don't want to look at this topic. As long as we feel young, that messy topic of death is far from us. The writer says, don't do that. You're going to miss the entire point of your existence here if you are living totally for what's under the sun. And so he says here, you be very, very careful that your heart is not turned away from that. And so what an important topic for us to think about. But he continues on. He says that remember that while your body may die, your name lives on. Now this sounds a bit contradictory, doesn't it? Because back in that first observation of life, he says you're going to die and be forgotten. And to an extent, that's right. But the idea here is, if anything survives, it's going to be your name. It's going to be your reputation. And that's what he starts off the chapter with when he says, a good name is better than precious ointment. It's something of value. So while you're here, he's saying, be a person of integrity. Be a person of respect. And when death does come, if anything survives, it's going to be your good reputation. It's going to be your good name. And we understand that. There are names of Christians I could mention right now that many of you would nod your heads and say, he was a wonderful man. She was a wonderful lady. Why? Their name has lived on. Their body hasn't. It's gone. So we have to be careful with that name. Here's a different look at death, he says, and it may not be quite as bad as you're thinking, at least in comparison to the first part of the book. Well, what else does he deal with here? He also says, when you think about these concerns that you have, there's a correct answer for it. When you say, I just don't know why God could allow that to happen, he says, you don't worry about it. There's an answer for it. God knows what he's going to do, and it's going to be the right thing. Well, what are some of these things we find in chapter 7? Well, first of all, it's one we've dealt with before. Verses 7 and 8, he says, justice will be served. Have you noticed how he keeps coming back to that idea as well? Injustice. What are some of the first words a child learns? That's not fair. How many times do you hear that? When your kids are little, that's not fair. We develop a sense of justice very early on. Sometimes we fight against it. But we develop that concept. And when the unjust seem to win, we have a hard time with that. The writer once again tells us, though, what he said before. He said, God's going to take care of it. In the end, the right thing will happen. So don't worry about it. It's not quite as bad as you think it might be. He also goes on to tell us that your problems are going to be solved a lot better if you don't grow angry about them. Look at verse 9. He says, do not be quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Well, you talk about laying something on the line. He does, doesn't he? He says, under the sun, that's how you deal with the problem. You yell and you scream and you fuss and you fight. That's how you deal with it under the sun. But he says, for the person who's transcending that, who's not a fool, you understand that anger is not the correct response. And that fits in as a piece of our puzzle. What do we want to do with injustice? We want to fight against it, don't we? We want to take care of it. And I think what the writer is saying is sometimes you can't. Sometimes no matter how hard you fight, you can't deal with it. God's going to handle it, though. So you keep yourself under control. Don't let anger be the motivation for solving problems, is what he's telling us. Another that he says, and I think this is quite interesting, he says you need to be content living in the present. Look at verse 10 with me. He says, say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Here's another one that hits us pretty hard the older we get. You know what we say. The good old days. Sure, we're better than where we're living now. The good old days, sure, we're nicer than the time we're living in. And what the writer is saying, if you say that, you're a fool. That's basically what he says. If you hearken back to the past and say, I just wish I could live back then again, he's saying you're foolish in that. He's telling us what you've done is you have had selective memory. Because in the good old days, there were problems. In the good old days, you had the same kind of vanity that you have now. I saw a book one time entitled, The Good Old Days. They were horrible. That's about right. You know, we hearken back to our good memories, but we forget all the bad ones. And the writer says, don't be like that. Don't live in the past. Don't say that those things were better than now. All you're doing is deceiving yourself. Live in the present. Deal with what's going on now, and you'll find your problems may not be quite as bad. He continues on to tell us again something we've heard before. He says, wisdom is good, but it's not the solution to everything. There are going to be things that even if you are a very wise person, you're still going to find that you can't deal much about. And so in verses 11 down through 14, he basically says, wisdom's kind of like money. It may solve some of your problems, but it's not going to solve them all. That's so different than what we usually think about with wisdom. And he's saying, when you're dealing with people under the sun, they're not going to respect good wisdom. They're not going to respect that godly wisdom. So just realize that bad things may happen even though you have the wisdom that you need to have. We accept this limited capacity and we trust that God's in control. You look at that list and you see these are things that we deal with on a very regular basis. These are things that we have to deal with. The writer is saying, just put them in perspective. Things aren't always as bad as they first appear. Well, as we move on toward the conclusion of this third observation of life, the writer is going to tell us here, not contradicting himself, but I think somewhat explaining himself. He's saying, don't let me discourage you about being wise. He's saying that wisdom is good, but the kind of wisdom that's going to bring you to be an above-the-sun thinker is a really rare commodity. You're just not going to find much of it on the earth. And as we look at verses 15 down through 29 of this chapter, we find that that's the case that he's making. One of the points that he's saying is really something he started out with when he said, wisdom is good, but it is no guarantee that you're going to have a great life. It's no guarantee that you're going to have a good life. How many times can you think about a Christian who has suffered because of somebody who just bilked them out of everything? Maybe took their inheritance, maybe took their house, maybe took their savings, some way deceived them. That person may be wise, but the writer says that does not guarantee that everything's going to be okay. Doesn't guarantee you're going to have a great life under the sun. Understand that is the point that he's making here. And so as he kind of breaks that idea down a bit, he says, first of all, don't be overconfident in that wisdom. And don't let that lead you to a self-righteousness. Let's go ahead and look here in chapter 7. Go with me. As we look down just a little bit further within the chapter, down to verses 16 and 17, he says, be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? You look at that passage, you think, well, is the writer telling me I can be too wise? Well, yeah. If that wisdom is based in your own righteousness, what's one of the big temptations for a wise person? It's to begin thinking he or she has all the answers. Now, that's a temptation. Here is somebody who may have really prepared their lives, may have studied the Bible, may have done all kinds of things, but yet in their wisdom, they've allowed self-righteousness to creep in. And so someone thinks he has the answer to everything that comes along. I promise you, he does not. Someone who can solve every problem you have and give you a solution to everything that you deal with, you better stay away from that person. Because that's a person who's become overly wise. That's a person who's become overly righteous. Now the writer says, don't go in the opposite direction. Don't say, well, if I can't be overly wise, what's the use? He says, don't be overly wicked either. And he's not giving us license for a little bit of wickedness there. He's just simply saying, don't go to the other extreme. Okay, so the point's made. Self-righteousness is not the answer. That's not a part of this wisdom. But again, he comes back and he says, if you keep your perspective, the godly wisdom that you find above the sun, it is going to have its advantages. And I tell you, one of my favorite parts of this section is when he says, down just a little bit further, let me find the verse here. If you look down to verse 19, he says, wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. You know what he's saying is? He's saying a wise person sure is better off than a consensus of politicians. He says, now I may have told you that wisdom doesn't answer everything, but now he says, let me tell you this, it does have its benefits. It's going to be better than what you find from the politicians. We understand that today, don't we? Someone who's giving an answer just simply to get popularity, simply to get attention, attraction, you're not going to find any wisdom there. So he says, while wisdom is rare and while it doesn't guarantee a good life, it will provide some profit. Secondly, he says, it's going to teach you against self-righteousness. Who's the truly wise person? Truly wise person is someone who, when you tell him your problem, he may very well say, I don't know that we can find an answer to that in this life. I don't know that we can understand that. That may be something you just have to deal with. We may not like that answer, but it may be the wise one, because he's not trying to promote himself. He's not trying to say, I know it all. I can answer all of your problems. No. True wisdom teaches against self-righteousness. It also keeps things in perspective. This again, boy, this is a good passage here. You look down to verse 21. He says, do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you have yourself cursed others. Boy, we get offended, don't we? We hear somebody's been talking bad about us. I can't believe someone said that about me. This writer says, do a little research in your own thoughts. When's the last time you spoke against someone else? So the writer is saying, you know what true wisdom does? It keeps everything in perspective. It doesn't keep you from being so offended when somebody does something to you that you have done many times over to them. That's something that we learn as well. And finally, he says, you need to understand that godly wisdom is very, very rare. It's interesting. He says, I looked for a wise man, and I found one man among 1,000 and no women who were wise. And I don't think he's being sexist there. I don't think that's a slam against women. I think all he's saying is you just can't find too many wise people around. You just can't find them. I did hear this described one time as Solomon was writing it. Look at the women that he had around him. You know, he had all of these pagans around him. He wouldn't find any wise women. But I think the point is, we're just not going to find that amongst many people. All right, we're going to kind of have to rush this last section, but that's okay. We'll hit it again tomorrow a little bit. He says, if you're wise, you're going to submit to the structure that God has in society. Here is another characteristic of someone who is wise. He says, first of all, it's very unwise to take on the king. Why is that? Who's in the position of authority? Who's in the position of power? And I think as well, what he's saying a bit of, and we find this within the scripture, where he says, the king in some ways represents God. Here is a sovereign. Here is somebody who's in control. Don't go up against that person. That's an unwise thing to do. Rebellions are an unwise way to go. Secondly, he says, here's the reasons for that. He's saying, if you obey the king, it's going to keep you out of trouble. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. But as long as it doesn't contradict the ways of God, obey him. That's a hard lesson for us. I tell you, living in a republic like we do, where we elect our leaders, and if you don't like them, you turn them out of office, that's hard for us to understand. But yet the writer would say to us, you follow those rules even that you don't like. Obey those things that really even may be a problem for you. You're going to find your life is better there. Because he says wisdom is seen in working in God's plan. And that's the thing. God has set up civil government. And the wise person says, I may not understand it all, but I'm going to follow God in all that I do. So then what happens when it appears that you serve an unwise leader? What happens when the king is foolish? What happens when the king has his thinking under the sun? God says, follow him anyway. Obey him anyway. That's the wise course. Because eventually, everything's going to be sorted out. Don't abandon God's plan. Because what may look like vanity under the sun actually may be a part of the workings of God. All right, so you look at what we find in chapter 8. And here's kind of a discourse on civil government. The writer is saying for the person who is truly seeking wisdom above the sun, he's going to follow the leader. He's going to do what he's told to do. He's going to respect the plan of God. And if things don't look like they're working out, he's going to say, God's got it under control. God's the one who has everything under control. And so that brings us to the third observation of life's conclusion. And as we think about that, we look down to verse 15. It's going to sound extremely familiar to us. He says, in my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous... wrong chapter. Chapter 8, verse 15. He says, and I commend joy for man. For man has no good thing under the sun, but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life. And God will give him, God has given him under the sun. The same conclusion we saw after view number one, and the same conclusion we saw after view number two, is the same conclusion we find after view number three. He says, I have looked, I have examined, I have researched life under the sun. Here's my advice to you, be happy with what you've got. God has given you these things, enjoy these things, and you'll find that this life is quite happy. All right, tomorrow, we're going to kind of break this up a little bit. We're going to look at the first part of that fourth observation, actually get through it, and then look at the first part of the conclusion that he begins to offer. And then, Lord willing, on Friday, we'll look at the grand conclusion and make some points based on that. Appreciate your attention this morning.